role. Make every role performed at excellence a respected profession. Many employees will still choose to climb the conventional ladder. And for those with the talent to manage others or to lead, this will be the right choice. However, guided by meaty incentives, many other employees will decide to redirect their energies toward growth in their current role. Great managers envision a company where there are multiple routes toward respect and prestige. A company where the best secretaries carry a vice president title. Where the best housekeepers earn twice as much as their supervisors. And where anyone performing at excellence is recognized publicly. If this sounds fanciful, here are a few techniques that great managers are already using to build such a company. Levels of achievement. How long does it take to become excellent in a chosen field? In a study called The Development of Talent Project, Dr. Benjamin Bloom of Northwestern University scrutinized the careers of world-class sculptors, pianists, chess masters, tennis players, swimmers, mathematicians, and neurologists. He discovered that across these diverse professions, it takes between 10 and 18 years before world-class competency is reached. If you showed some interest, he would become even more specific. For example, it takes 17.14 years from your first piano lessons to your victory at the Van Cliburn, Tchaikovsky, or Chopin piano competitions. While figures like this can feel a little too precise, Dr. Bloom's general point is nevertheless well taken. The exact length of time will vary by person and profession. But whether you are a teacher, a nurse, a salesperson, an engineer, a pilot, a waiter, or a neurosurgeon, it still takes years to become the world's best. As Hippocrates, the philosopher and founder of modern medicine, observed, life is short. The art is long. If a company wants some employees in every role to approach world-class performance, it must find ways to encourage them to stay focused on developing their expertise. Defining graded levels of achievement for every role is an extremely effective way of doing just that. Lawyers figured this out a long time ago. The young lawyer, fresh out of law school, selects his field of expertise. Corporate law, criminal law, tax law, is hired into that field by a law firm and joins as a junior associate. Over the next 4 or 5 years, he will be promoted to associate and then to senior associate. As a senior associate, he will still be practicing law in his chosen field. He will simply be more accomplished. Over the next 5 years, he will hopefully be promoted to some kind of equity position in the firm, where he will start as a junior partner, move up to partner, and then be promoted to senior partner. As a senior partner in the firm, he will garner a tremendous amount of respect and earn a very generous salary. Yet, he will still be practicing the same kind of law as he was back in his junior associate days. The work will be more complex. And he will have his pick of the most interesting and most lucrative work. The only difference is that, by now, he will be one of the world experts in his chosen field. Law firms are rarely considered cutting-edge organizations, but with their use of graded levels of achievement, they are far ahead of most companies. Although all lawyers are free to choose more conventional career paths, moving into the management of other lawyers, perhaps, or becoming a legal generalist for a corporation, these levels of achievement provide lawyers with an alternative but equally respected path to growth. It is a path that offers them the opportunity to become experts and a simple way to track their progress. Lawyers aren't the only ones to realize the power of these levels of achievement. In medicine, the levels build from intern all the way to senior consultant over a period of, at minimum, 15 years. In professional sports, You can measure your expertise as you progress from rookie to second string to starter to all-star. In sales, the entry grade might be the million-dollar round table, an important first step for the fledgling salesperson. But the pinnacle is the President's Club, where the criteria for membership are $10 million in sales and perfect client service scores. And in music, you track your progress not by whether you are promoted from the violin to the conductor, but rather by your journey from the most junior third chair violinist to concertmaster or first chair associate. In fact, anywhere individual excellence is revered, you will find these graded levels of achievement. Conversely, if you cannot find them, it means that, either overtly or accidentally, the company does not value excellence in that role. And by this standard, companies don't value excellence in most roles. As we stated earlier, great managers rebel against this. They believe instead that every role performed at a level of excellence is valuable, that there is virtuosity in every role. So no matter how menial the role appears, they work hard to define meaningful criteria that can help a dedicated employee track his or her progress toward world-class performance. AT&T provides help desk solutions to hundreds of companies. AT&T managers decided to organize each help desk according to the complexity of the client's question. Level 1 deals with simple queries like, "How can I turn on my computer?" Level 2 addresses slightly more difficult issues. Level 3 handles the panicked, "What do I do? I think I've just crashed our entire intranet," inquiries. These three distinct levels are not only the most efficient way to structure the operation, each level has a different pace, a different call volume, and so on, but they also provide a genuine career path for employees who want to grow into superior technicians rather than into supervisors. At Phillips Petroleum, managers provide employees with a well-respected engineer career track. If the employee can show proficiency in the required procedures, then she can gradually progress through the different levels of this career path, all the way up to a director-level position, where she will be recognized as one of the most accomplished engineers in the firm. In the mid-1980s, Gallup worked with Allied Breweries to measure the performance of bartenders in pubs. One of the signs of greatness in bartending is an ability to remember not only the names of regulars, but also the drinks that go with them. We devised a program called the 100 Club. Any bartender who could prove that he knew 100 names and the drinks to match would be awarded a button and a cash prize. The levels progressed up to the world-class 500 Club, which brought better prizes and bigger bonuses. When we started the 100 Club with Allied Breweries, few managers believed that any bartender would ever reach the 500 Club level. But by 1990, Janice Kay, a bartender in a pub in the north of England, became the first member of the 3,000 Club. She knew the names of 3,000 regulars and their favorite beverages. From this angle, Janice was the best bartender in the world. It just goes to show that in most cases, no matter what it is, if you measure it and reward it, people will try to excel at it. These are just a few examples of managers guiding employees with a series of levels that lead to world-class performance. Levels of achievement like these are invaluable for a manager. When confronted by that thorny question, "Where do I go from here?" the manager can now offer a specific and respected alternative to the blind, breathless climb up. Broadbanding. These levels of achievement will certainly help redirect an employee's focus toward becoming world-class. However, the manager's efforts at career redirection will be forever hindered if all of the pay signals are telling the employee to look upward. Although each of us is motivated by money in different ways, the fact of the matter is that few of us are repelled by money. All of us may not hunger for it, but only a tiny minority of us find money positively distasteful. Therefore, the simple truth is that it will be much easier for managers to redirect employees toward alternative career paths if some of those paths involve a raise in pay. The ideal pay plan would allow the company to compensate the person in direct proportion to the amount of expertise she showed in her current role. The more she excelled, the more she would earn. In practice, this ideal plan is complicated by the fact that some roles are simply more valuable than others. On balance, a pilot is probably more valuable than a flight attendant. A principal is more valuable than a teacher. A restaurant manager is more valuable than a waiter. Any pay plan must take these value differentials into account. But before we design our plan, there is one final twist to consider. Some roles performed excellently are more valuable than roles higher up the ladder performed averagely. An excellent flight attendant is probably more valuable than an average pilot. A brilliant teacher is more valuable than a novice principal. A superstar waiter is more valuable than a mediocre restaurant manager. The perfect pay plan must be sophisticated enough to reflect this overlap. Simple and effective, it is called broadbanding. For each role, you define pay in broad bands or ranges, with the top end of the lower level role overlapping the bottom end of the role above. For example, at Merrill Lynch, the top end of the pay band for financial consultants is over $500,000 a year. In contrast, the bottom end of the branch manager pay band is $150,000 a year. This means that if you are a successful financial consultant and you want to move into a manager role, you might have to endure a 70% pay cut. The upside for the novice manager is that the top end of the manager pay band runs into the millions. So while you may have to stomach the 70% pay cut initially, if you prove yourself to be excellent at managing others, then in the end, you will reap significant financial rewards. The Walt Disney Company takes a similar approach. As a brilliant server in one of their fine dining restaurants, you might earn over $60,000 a year. If you choose to climb into the manager career path, your starting salary will be $25,000 a year. Again, once you start to excel as a manager and are promoted up and through the various supervisory levels, your total compensation package can take you far above $60,000. But initially, your pay packet will be sliced in half. Even traditional hierarchical organizations are starting to experiment with broadbanding. Martin P., the chief of police for a state capital in the Midwest, describes the conventional career path from police officer to police sergeant, the frontline supervisor role, to police captain, he removed the lieutenant role a couple of years ago, to assistant chief to police chief. Time was, he says, when the only way to earn more money was to move into management, to go from officer to sergeant. Now all my pay grades overlap. If you are a superb police officer, you don't need to get promoted to sergeant to earn more. The fact is, my very best police officers earn more than their captain does. On the surface, broadbanding appears disorienting. Frontline employees earning two or three times what their managers earn? This is a world turned upside down. On closer scrutiny, however, broadbanding makes sense. First, with its broad bands of pay, it provides a way to value world-class performance in a particular role, very differently from average performance in that role. As with levels of achievement, wherever individual excellence is revered, we see broadbanding. In professional sports, no matter what the position, the superstars at that position earn multiples greater than the average players in the same position. This also applies to actors, musicians, artists, singers, and writers. In all of these professions, the broad range in pay encourages the person to refine his talents and so become world class. Great managers advise us to apply the same logic to all roles. Second, with its overlapping bands of pay, broadbanding slows the blind, breathless climb up. It forces the employee to open her eyes and ask, "Why am I angling for this next promotion? Why am I pushing so hard to climb onto the next rung?" Without broadbanding, the answer to these questions is clouded by her knowledge that the next rung brings more money. With broadbanding, the employee can answer only by examining the content of the role and weighing the match between its responsibilities and her strengths. Her answers will be more honest and more accurate. She will make her career choices based at least as much on fit as on finances. Some companies take broadbanding to its limits. At Stryker, a $2 billion medical device manufacturer, the pay band for salespeople ranges from $40,000 for a novice to $250,000 for the best of the best. If you decide to move into the manager ranks, you have to take a 60% pay cut. The starting salary for a new regional manager is just under $100,000 a year. What is intriguing is that the top end of the manager band, about $200,000 in total compensation, is lower than the top end for salespeople. The best regional manager in the company can never earn as much as the best salesperson. Why would Stryker choose to do this? All manner of reasons. The company values its best salespeople very highly. It wants to entice its best salespeople to stay close to the customer for as long as possible. It wants each employee to think long and hard before climbing onto the manager ladder. Whatever the reasons, Stryker's pay plan has proven very successful. Powered by the best salespeople and the best managers in the business, Stryker has achieved 20% annual growth in sales and profit for the last 20 years. Broadbanding is a vital weapon in the arsenal of great managers. It gives teeth to their commitment that every role performed at excellence will be valued. And if the Stryker example appears a little extreme, remember this. During Gallup's interviews with great managers, we found a consistent willingness to hire employees who, the managers knew, might soon earn significantly more than they did. Creative acts of revolt. Great managers have to survive in a hostile world. Most companies do not value excellence in every role. They do not provide alternative career paths for their employees, and they do not give their managers the leeway to design graded levels of achievement or broadbanded pay plans. If you find yourself living in this restricted world, what can you do? Brian Jay can tell you. His advice? Revolt, quietly and creatively. Brian manages artists in a large media company. His company has seen fit to construct an intricate hierarchy comprising over 30 distinct pay grades, each with clearly defined benefits and perks. One of the rules within this elaborate structure is that you cannot be promoted to a director-level position unless you manage other people. Another rule is that only directors are granted such perks as stock options and first-class seating when traveling. "I was caught between a rock and a hard place," Brian says. "I wanted to show some of my best graphic artists how valuable they were, but rules are rules. I couldn't reward them with a director-level promotion without promoting them to a manager role. But I didn't want to promote them to a manager role because that's not their talent. So instead, I asked each of them to become mentors for junior graphic artists. They wouldn't manage these people, they would just be expected to pass on their expertise. I then went to Human Resources and said that, as far as I was concerned, a mentor was the equivalent of a manager, and so I had a right to promote them to a director-level position. HR took some convincing, but I got my way in the end. Garth P. tells a similar story. He runs an applied technology division in an aeronautics company. In his production facilities, he employs hundreds of technical specialists. The best engineer I had was a guy named Michael. We've got a pretty rigid structure here, so whenever we wanted to reward Michael, we had to promote him up the ladder. After 10 years of promotions, he found himself doing less and less of the engineering he loved, and more people management, which, to be frank, he struggled at. So together, we decided to create a new position, Master Engineer. Michael would be a roving genius, getting involved in only the most complex projects. He would also be the main resource and the last word on all engineering problems any of the other teams faced. And he would be freed from any manager responsibilities at all. I decreed that this was a vice president-level job, got the okay from personnel, and then promoted him. I can't think of when I've made an employee happier. Laura T., an executive in a Texas-based petrochemical company, faced a similar situation but solved it in a slightly different way. I have lots of people who want to grow and who deserve to be recognized, but since we aren't growing right now, new positions aren't opening up. So I take my top performers and assign them to special projects. These projects are ad hoc. They have a specific objective with a specific timeline. Once the objective is met, the project team disbands. Special projects like this work really well for me because they give my talented employees a chance to grow, and at the same time, they give me a chance to recognize each of them for excellent work. I got permission from HR to reward each successful team member with a gift certificate for a weekend in Dallas and seats to a Cowboys game. Recognition like that might not sound like a big deal to you, but for a traditional petrochemical company like ours, it's a whole new way of thinking. Each of these managers, in his or her own way, is providing alternative routes toward growth and prestige. Each of them, maneuvering within a restricted world, is devising innovative ways to reward employees for excellent performance without necessarily promoting these employees out of their current roles. Each of them is trying to create heroes in every role. Three stories and a new career. What is the force driving the new career? Today's unpredictable business climate has undoubtedly caused a shift in the employer-employee relationship. Employers, acutely aware of the need to be nimble, can no longer guarantee lifelong employment. All they are willing to offer the employee is lifelong employability. We will provide you with marketable experiences that will make you attractive to other employers should we ever need to cut back our labor costs. This is certainly a shift from 20 years ago, but great managers contend that it is merely a superficial shift. Very little of substance has changed. Conventional wisdom's core assumption about careers remains the same, and it remains wrong. It assumes that the energy for a career should emanate from the employee's desire to better herself, to fill herself out with attractive experiences. She should not linger long in one particular role. Instead, she should skip from one role to the next every couple of years, so that over time, her resume becomes impressively varied. Under the terms of lifelong employment, the employees with the most impressive resumes were the most likely to be selected for the next rung on the internal ladder. Under the terms of lifelong employability, the employees with these attractive resumes are the most likely to be snapped up externally by a new company. The location may be different, but the assumption is the same. Varied experiences make an employee attractive. Therefore, from conventional wisdom's perspective, a career can be best understood as the employee's focused search for interesting and marketable experiences. Great managers disagree. Acquiring varied experiences is important, but peripheral to a healthy career. It is an accessory, not the driving force. The true source of energy for a healthy career, they say, is generated elsewhere. Listen to enough of their stories and you can start to figure out where. They tell stories of people who took a step, looked in the mirror, and discovered something about themselves. In some cases, the person looked in the mirror spontaneously. In others, he had to be coaxed to turn his head before seeing himself clearly. There are stories where the discovery was a confirmation to stay the course. There are stories, like the three that follow, where the discovery prompts a change in direction. But whatever the details of the story, it is always the same story. Their recurring story reveals that self-discovery is the driving, guiding force for a healthy career. The energy for a healthy career is generated from discovering the talents that are already there, not from filling oneself up with marketable experiences. Self-discovery is a long process, never fully achieved. Nonetheless, great managers know that it is this search for a full understanding of your talents and non-talents that serves as the source of energy powering your career. Number 1. Dr. No's Story. George H. was the vice president of development in a large real estate development company. He had risen through the ranks as a project manager, and now, midway through his career, he found himself second in command to a creative, articulate risk taker named Howard P. George was perfectly suited to his role. While Howard dreamed up wildly elaborate and expensive schemes, George identified all of the impediments and all of the pitfalls that could derail Howard's plan. George called this his parade of horribles. Everyone called George Dr. No. Dr. No was respected and admired. He was honorable, courageous, and detail-oriented. And the whole company knew that every plan was strengthened by exposure to Dr. No's refining fire. He was a most valuable executive. Then Howard left, and Dr. No was promoted. And quite soon he lost the admiration of his colleagues. You see, Dr. No's particular talent was to make small things out of big things. This talent had enabled him to take Howard's crazy ideas and break them down into manageable projects, each of which could then be analyzed for costs, benefits, and risks. But this talent was rendered useless without raw material, without a dreamer to dream up the humongous, outrageous idea. And the dreamer had moved on. There were others in the company who would now present Dr. No with an Everest of an idea, but he would immediately slice it up into a series of middling hillocks, small projects, low risk. And, thus dismantled, the idea lost its impact. It was no longer worth the effort. By the middle of his first year, Dr. No had red-lighted every single project. Dr. No knew what he was doing, but strangely, he couldn't prevent it. When he imagined the sheer size of the risk, so many variables all out of his control, he would feel his throat begin to constrict. As he played out the project in greater and greater detail, his throat would close so tightly that he could barely breathe. It happened every time, and a little worse each time. At work, he now felt physical pain and the attack of panic. Panicky feelings like this can sometimes bring clarity. As the year progressed, Dr. No came to understand what everyone else already knew. He would never get anything going. The talents that had served him so well as the dreamer's partner would forever strangle the organization. Left to his own devices, he would always kill big ideas. So Dr. No removed himself from the position. He set himself up as an independent contractor. He would be paid to conceive, design, and execute lots and lots of small ideas. He can breathe more easily now. Number 2, a touching story. Mary G. has powerful forearms and fingers that are as strong and as firm as they appear. Standing up straight above you, she has shoulders that seem to stretch from wall to wall, and as she reaches back to twist her hair out of the way, you notice that her elbows are surprisingly rounded. Later, when she bears down on them, they feel as though they must be 6 inches across. It is a good feeling. Mary is a massage therapist, and she was born to touch. Other people's bodies fascinate me. When someone is lying in front of me, it's like their skin is transparent. I can see the bands of muscles stretched up and around their shoulder blades, across their back and down their legs. I can see where the muscles are pulled taut and where they are all scrunched up in an angry little knot. I can almost see the nerves, too. I sense that with one person, they might like long strokes that pump the muscle and get the blood going. With someone else, they might prefer shiatsu. That's a technique where you use pressure points on the body to stimulate the nerve endings and open up the whole nervous system. Everyone is different. 3 years after finishing her training, Mary was the most sought-after therapist at the exclusive Arizona health spa where she worked. The word had spread. If you want a massage that pummels and loosens and opens you up, but with no pain, you must schedule with Mary. Soon, her employer decided to promote her to manage all of the massage therapists at the resort. This meant more money, more security, better benefits, and fewer appointments of her own. And she was miserable. I missed the intimacy. As a massage therapist, I stand in a room with another person for an hour or more in silence and look through their skin and see their pain and ease their pain. I come to love each one just a little bit. I love the immediate gratification of releasing someone's stress. They look different afterward, immediately afterward. Their skin looks brighter, their eyes are clearer, and I know it will last. It is a great feeling for me, and I hope for them. Mary wanted to get that feeling back, so she quit her job, moved to Los Angeles, and set up her own practice. Her appointment book is filled up, and once again, Mary gets to touch people every single day. Number 3. Mandy's designer story. We met Mandy back in Chapter 5. She is the manager of a department that designs logos and other images to drive a product's brand identity. She tells this story. I inherited a design consultant named Janet. A design consultant has two responsibilities. First, interact with the clients and find out their needs. And second, manage the designers so that they deliver what the client wanted. Janet was very ambitious and very talented. But she wasn't performing either of these roles very well. She wasn't failing, but she wasn't a star either. And she was the kind of person who needed to be a star. She realized pretty quickly that I thought she was mediocre. So her attitude took a dive. She wouldn't tell me directly, but I got word from her best friend in the office that she wanted me to fire her so that she could collect unemployment. It pissed me off that she wouldn't come clean with me. But I was damned if I was going to let her manipulate me into firing her. I wanted her to be honest with herself about her feelings and her intentions. I wanted her to understand that in the end, she would be rewarded for her honesty. So I waited her out. And over a period of about 4 months, we started to talk. We discussed her performance, strengths, weaknesses, likes, and dislikes, that kind of thing. I told her that it wasn't her fault she wasn't excelling in this role, but that together, we would have to find a solution. Then one day it occurred to me that she should go back to school and become a designer herself. She was very curious about the business, very creative, and much preferred to do a job by herself. She played with the idea for a while, and then she acted on it. She enrolled at New York University, got her degree, and is now at a large advertising agency as a designer, and very successful. Janet wasn't a bad person, she had just picked the wrong career, and having started it, she didn't want to admit to herself that she had made a mistake. I helped her. With self-discovery as its energy source, great managers now paint this picture of a healthy career. Guided, perhaps, by her choice of college major, perhaps by her family, perhaps by necessity, the employee selects her first role and jumps into the fray. In this first role, she is unsure of herself. She is unsure of her ability to perform and unsure of her talents and her non-talents. As she achieves certain levels of performance, she might then move into different roles, or she might simply grow within that first role. Either way, it is now her responsibility to look in the mirror and ask, "Do I thrill to this role? Do I seem to learn this role quickly? Am I good in this role? Does this role bring me strength and satisfaction?" It is her responsibility to listen for the clues that this role plays to her talents. She might have started in sales, then moved into marketing. In this new role, does she like being further removed from the customer? Does she love dealing with the patterns and concepts inherent in marketing? Or does she miss the direct interaction and the knowledge that she and she alone made that sale? She might have started as a flight attendant and then moved into the training department. Does she like helping novice flight attendants grow? Or does she yearn for the drama and the challenge of winning over tired, nervous passengers? As she looks in the mirror, she learns. Each step is the chance to discover a little more about her talents and her non-talents. These discoveries guide her next step, and her next, and her next. Her career is no longer a blind hunt for marketable experiences and a breathless climb upward. It has become an increasingly refined series of choices as she narrows her focus toward that role, or roles, where her strengths, her skills, knowledge, and talents, converge and resound. Deep down, most people probably know that self-discovery is important to building a healthy career. The difference lies in the way great managers use self-discovery. First, they give self-discovery a central role, making it an explicit expectation for each employee. Mike C., a manager in a courier company, describes how he turns self-discovery from a theoretical concept into a simple, practical demand. "When someone joins the team, I tell him that one of our major goals in working together is to help him figure out who he is. I tell him to look in the mirror. And if he doesn't know how to do that, I tell him to use the Sunday night blues test. If he doesn't feel that little stab of depression on Sunday night, if he actually finds himself looking forward to the week, then he should stop and ask himself why. What is it about the role that he loves so much? Whatever he answers, he should scribble it down and make sure that he keeps it in mind when he chooses another role. If he does feel those Sunday night blues coming on every weekend, then it's not necessarily his fault. It's not some failing in him, but he does need to ask the same question why. What does he need that his current role is not giving him? Again, he should bear his answer in mind as he looks for other places to work." Managers like Mike aren't suggesting that gaining varied experiences is a bad idea. Simply that it is insufficient. They know that an employee will fail to find the roles that fit him if he spends his career gorging himself on skills and experiences while neglecting to look in the mirror. An approach to career building that is as likely to succeed as is trying to build a healthy body by popping vitamins and diet pills while neglecting to exercise. Second, these exemplary managers emphasize that the point of self-discovery is not to fix your non-talents. The point is not to identify and fill in your skill gaps, as many human resources departments euphemistically describe it. In the spirit of the insight, you cannot put in what was left out. You can only draw out what was left in. The point of self-discovery is to learn about yourself so that you can capitalize on who you are. The point is to take control of your career, to make more informed decisions, and to gradually select roles that represent an increasingly good fit for your natural talents. The manager and the new career. How can the manager help? In the new career, the employee is the star. It is his responsibility to take control of his career. It is his responsibility to look in the mirror and make sound choices based on what he discovers. But what role should the manager play? She's no longer the gatekeeper, picking and choosing from among the most attractive, the most skilled, and the most experienced supplicants. What is her role? One could make a case for saying that since the employee is the star, and since companies can no longer guarantee lifelong employment, the manager's role has become less significant. She should focus her people on performance today, but not concern herself with where they are headed tomorrow. The employee should figure that out for himself. Besides, if the manager invests too much in her people, she might soon be disappointed. Given the speed of change today, she might well end up having to terminate the people she has nurtured so carefully. The best managers reject this perspective. They know that in this new career, they can play some significant roles. They can level the playing field. They can be the ones to hold up the mirror, and they can create a safety net. Great managers level the playing field. This is why creating new heroes, designing graded levels of achievement, and establishing broad-banded pay plans are all so important. These techniques provide an environment where money and prestige are spread throughout the organization. Since the employee now knows he can acquire them through a variety of different paths, money and prestige become less of a factor in his decision-making. He is free to choose his path based on his current understanding of his talents and non-talents. He may still make the occasional misstep, but he is much more likely to gravitate not only toward roles where he excels, but toward roles that bring him lasting satisfaction and that he yearns to play for a very long time. On this leveled playing field, you hear conversations that you never thought you would hear, like the one Jeff H., the computer software sales manager, had with his supervisor. "I love my role. I'm the best in the company at it. I'm making a lot of money doing it, and I'm having more of an impact than I ever thought was possible in my life. So I said to my boss, 'Your one objective with me is to see to it that I am never promoted again. If you can do that, you have me for life.'" Great managers hold up the mirror. Great managers excel at holding up the mirror. They excel at giving performance feedback. Don't confuse this with the once-a-year performance appraisal chore, with its labyrinthine form-filling and remedial focus, or with the empty, arbitrary employee-of-the-month feedback. The feedback great managers give is quite different. It is the kind of feedback that Laura T., the petrochemical executive, gives to her people. She describes a program called Excel, where she meets with each of her 22 direct reports once every quarter. In these meetings, we quickly review the last 3 months, and then it's on to the good stuff, the next 3 months. What are their plans and their goals? What measurements will we use? With each of them, we talk about what they enjoy doing and how we can structure things so that they get to do more of that. Martin P., the police chief, is less structured, but has the same kinds of conversations. "I have 16 direct reports, and with each of them, I probably spend about 20 minutes each week talking about their performance, the project they're working on, how they can improve, and what I can do to help. These discussions happen all the time. With one of my guys, we went to a convention together last month. We accomplished nothing at the convention, but we did on the plane, in the rental car, over dinner, and in the lobby of the hotel. Jeff H. simply schedules time to travel on sales calls with each of his salespeople once or twice a quarter. I try not to play the role of the knight on the white horse, riding in and saving the day. Instead, I just travel with them, listen to their challenges, and watch them with clients. I need to get a granular look at them at work. Back at the office, I replay what I saw for them. We then talk about plans and goals, and together we figure out the best way forward. My role isn't to correct or fix. My role is to keep them aware of their style and to keep them realistic about what is possible given that style. Other great managers make use of 360-degree feedback techniques, psychological profiles, employee opinion surveys, or customer comment cards. Whatever their style, whatever their tools of choice, they are all trying to do the same thing. Hold up the mirror so that the employee has a chance to discover a little more about who he is, how he works, and the footprint he leaves on the world. Although each manager employed his or her own approach to feedback, in the study of great managers, Gallup found that their approaches did share three characteristics. First, their feedback was constant. They varied the frequency according to the preferences or the needs of the individual employee, but whether the meetings happened for 20 minutes every month or for an hour every quarter, these performance feedback meetings were, nonetheless, a constant part of their interaction with each employee throughout the year. How much of a time commitment did this represent? According to the managers and Gallup study, the total time they spent discussing each employee's style and performance was roughly 4 hours per employee per year. And as one frontline supervisor said, if you can't spend 4 hours a year with each of your people, then you've either got too many people or you shouldn't be a manager. Second, each session began with a brief review of past performance. The purpose of this was not to evaluate. You should do less of that. You should fix this. Rather, the purpose was to help the employee think in detail about her style and to spark a conversation about the talents and non-talents that created this style. After this review, the focus always shifted to the future and how the employee could use her style to be productive. Sometimes they would work together to identify the employee's path of least resistance toward her goals. But often, the discussion would revolve around partnership. What talents did the manager bring that could complement the non-talents of the employee? During that convention trip, most of Martin P.'s conversations dealt with partnership. This guy is incredibly driven, incredibly goal-oriented, but he lacks strategic thinking. He has a hard time imagining what obstacles might get in his way as he plows ahead. I can help him here. I can play out alternative scenarios for him, and then we could put together contingency plans should any of these scenarios actually happen. Jeff H. gives a similar description. One of my salespeople knows all the tricks for getting her foot in the door and asking the right questions, but she lacks creativity when it comes to pricing the deal. I'm pretty good at that. So when we meet, she tells me the players and the situation, and I tell her whether she should present a leasing option, a buyback option, a volume discount deal, or whatever. Third, great managers made a point of giving their feedback in private, one-on-one. The purpose of feedback is to help each individual understand and build on his natural talents. You cannot do this in a group setting. This sounds obvious, but given today's preoccupation with teamwork, it is surprising how many managers forget the importance of spending time alone with each of their people. As Phil Jackson, the extraordinarily successful coach of the Chicago Bulls, observes, I prefer to deal with the players on an individual basis. This helps strengthen my one-on-one connection with the players, who sometimes get neglected because we spend so much of our time together en masse. Meeting with players privately helps me stay in touch with who they are out of uniform. During the 1995 playoffs, for instance, Toni Kukoc was troubled by reports that Split, Croatia, where his parents live, had been hit by a barrage of artillery fire. It took several days for him to get through on the phone and learn that his family was all right. The war in his homeland is a painful reality of Tony's life. If I ignored that, I probably wouldn't be able to relate to him on any but the most superficial level. Getting to know you. With descriptions like this, Phil Jackson helps provide an answer to the manager's age-old question, should you build close personal relationships with your employees, or does familiarity breed contempt? The most effective managers say yes, you should build personal relationships with your people, and no, familiarity does not breed contempt. This does not mean that you should necessarily become best friends with those who report to you, although if that is your style, and if you keep them focused on performance outcomes, there's nothing wrong with doing so. The same applies to socializing with your people. If that is not your style, don't do it. If it is your style, then there is nothing damaging about having dinner or a drink with them, as long as you still evaluate them on performance outcomes. When great managers like Phil Jackson say they build close relationships with their people, when they say that familiarity does not breed contempt, they simply mean that a great manager must get to know his employees. And getting to know someone extends beyond a detailed understanding of an employee's talents and non-talents. It extends all the way to the practicalities and dramas of his personal life. The great manager does not necessarily have to intervene in the employee's life, although some do, but she does have to know about it, and she does have to care about it. During Gallup's 80,000 manager interviews, we asked this question. You have a talented employee who consistently shows up late for work. What would you say to this employee? The answers ranged from the authoritarian to the laissez-faire. I would fire him. We don't tolerate lateness here. I would give him a verbal warning, then a written warning, then fire him. I would lock the door to the office and tell him that from now on, even if you are 2 seconds late, you won't be allowed in. That's fine. I don't care what time they come in, as long as they stay late and get their work done. Each of these responses is defensible. Each has its merits. But these were not the answers of great managers. When told that an employee was consistently showing up late for work, the great managers gave this one reply, which sums up their attitude toward manager-employee relationships. I would ask why. Maybe it has something to do with a bus schedule. Maybe he has to wait for a nanny to arrive. Maybe there's trouble at home. Once they had understood the employee's personal situation, great managers might take any number of different actions, ranging from changing the employee's hours to telling him to get the situation sorted out fast. But no matter what the next step, their first step was always to get to know the employee. Ask why. Phil Jackson's comments about personal relationships end with this line. Athletes are not the most verbal breed. That's why bare attention and listening without judgment are so important. Great managers create a safety net. The conventional career path lacks forgiveness. As the employee climbs from rung to rung, the rungs are burned behind him. If he climbs onto a rung and struggles, he knows that his reputation will suffer and his job will be in jeopardy. There is no turning back. By punishing career missteps so severely, this path discourages everyone from taking bold career steps. In conventional wisdom's world, taking bold career steps to discover a latent talent or to refine an existing one is almost as foolhardy as volunteering to learn the trapeze without a safety net. No wonder people are so protective of their careers, so closed to their own feedback, and so reluctant to change their career track based on what they have discovered about themselves. This career path kills learning. Great managers want to encourage career learning. They want to promote active self-discovery. So they have devised their own makeshift career safety net, trial periods. Ellen P., the manager of in-flight training at Southwest Airlines, describes the safety net she built. It is a big step for a flight attendant to move out of the planes and into the training room. Some people want to become a trainer because they will get to travel less. We knock those people out right away. But others talk about wanting to teach and wanting to pass on the tradition of Southwest. If we think they have the talent, and if we think they are seeking the job for the right reasons, then we bring them in for a 6-month trial period. We are very explicit that this is a time for them and for us to decide if this is really something that they will love to do for a long time. People don't realize that teaching is hard. We do teach ideas for having fun with the guests and playing games and telling jokes, but there is a lot of boring detail to communicate and a lot of rules for the students to learn. This trial period is a way for them to get a sense of how they like this kind of work. During the trial period, we sit down with them once a month and discuss their performance, what they are really enjoying, and where they are struggling. We send other trainers in to evaluate them and give them feedback. And at the end of the 6 months, they have to pass certain tests to show that they have learned all the necessary information. Most do exactly that, and we now have a really talented group of trainers. But all of our trainees knew that if, during the trial period, either they or the company felt that they were not a fit, they would have been able to go back to the planes and resume their flight attendant role. And that's happened a couple of times over the last few years. There was no shame in that, no failure. These people wanted to experiment and to learn if they could be trainers. They took the step and learned that teaching was not for them. It worked out great for us, too. They are back on the planes now, focused on our guests, and undistracted by vague thoughts of moving into training. They have closed that door. They can move on. Trial periods are tricky. You must not use them as a substitute for selection. Like Ellen, you should use them only with people who have already shown some talent and some genuine interest in the role. After all, your main focus as a manager is not to help every employee play around within the company in the hope of finding something they like to do. Your main focus is to drive performance by matching the talent to the role. Even if an employee begs and pleads for a chance to discover a new talent, if you know he doesn't have it, don't offer him the trial period. Furthermore, if you use a trial period, then, like Ellen, you must be very clear about the details. How long will it last? What criteria will you use to assess fit? How often, if at all, will you meet during the trial period to discuss performance? Where will the employee go if she does not stay in the new role? You must answer all of these questions explicitly if the trial period is to be a success. Finally, and most significant, you must make it clear that the employee will be moved back into his previous role if either you or he is unhappy with the fit. This will prevent any unfortunate misunderstandings. The trial period is not just for his benefit, it is also for yours. If, after the trial period is over, he loves the role, but you perceive a misfit, your assessment wins. He may not be happy with this, but at least he will not feel ambushed. The Art of Tough Love. How do great managers terminate someone and still keep the relationship intact? Whether an employee is at the end of a trial period or just struggling along in his current role, it is still difficult to bring him bad news. It is still difficult to tell him that he needs to move out of his role. During Gallup's interviews, many managers, both great and average,